Why? She asked. Why did you need me to do this?
I hesitated. Hypothetically, there could be contamination.
Such a hard face. Jaw tight. Hypothetically, why would you be any more or less contaminated than me?
I shrugged.
No particular reason. I was the first one to find the words on the wall, though.
She looked at me as if I had spouted nonsense, laughed harshly.
We're in so much deeper than that. Do you really think those masks we wore are going to keep us safe from whatever's going on here?
She was wrong. I thought she was wrong, but I didn't correct her. People trivialize or simplify data for so many reasons. There was nothing else to be said. She went back to her work as I squinted through the microscope at the sample from whatever had killed the anthropologist. At first, I didn't know what I was looking at because it was so unexpected. It was brain tissue. And not just any brain tissue. The cells were remarkably human, with some irregularities. My thought at the time was that the sample had been corrupted, but if so, not by my presence. The surveyor's notes perfectly described what I saw, and when she looked at the sample again later, she confirmed its unchanged nature. I kept squinting through the microscope lens and raising my head and squinting again, as if I couldn't see the sample correctly. Then I settled down and stared at it until it became just a series of squiggles and circles. Was it really human? Was it pretending to be human? As I said, there were irregularities. And how had the anthropologist taken the sample? Just walked up to the thing with an ice cream scoop and asked, "Can I take a biopsy of your brain?" No. The sample had to come from the margins, from the exterior, which meant it couldn't be brain tissue, which meant it was definitely not human. I felt unmoored, drifting once again. About then, the surveyor strode over and threw the developed photographs down on my table. "Useless," she said. Every photograph of the words on the wall was a riot of luminous, out-of-focus color. Every photograph of anything other than the words had come out as pure darkness. The few in-between photos were also out of focus. I knew this was probably because of the slow, steady breathing of the walls, which might also have been giving off some kind of heat or other agent of distortion. A thought that made me realize I had not taken a sample of the walls. I had recognized the words were organisms. I had known the walls were too. But my brain had still registered walls as inert, part of the structure. Why sample them?
I know, the surveyor said, misunderstanding my cursing. Any luck with the samples?
No luck at all, I said, still staring at the photographs. Anything in the maps or papers? The surveyor snorted.
Not a damn thing. Nothing except they all seemed fixated on the lighthouse, watching the lighthouse, going to the lighthouse, living in the goddamn lighthouse.
So we have nothing.
The surveyor ignored that, said, What do we do now?
It was clear she hated asking the question. Eat dinner, I said. Take a little stroll along the perimeter to make sure the psychologist isn't hiding in the bushes. Think about what we're doing tomorrow.
I'll tell you one thing we're not doing tomorrow. We're not going back into the tunnel.
Tower. She glared at me. There was no point in arguing with her. At dusk, the familiar moaning came to us from across the salt marsh flats as we ate our dinner around the campfire. I hardly noticed it, intent on my meal. The food tasted so good, and I did not know why. I gobbled it up, had seconds, while the surveyor, baffled, just stared at me. We had little or nothing to say to each other. Talking would have meant planning, and nothing I wanted to plan would please her. The wind picked up, and it began to rain. I saw each drop fall as a perfect faceted liquid diamond, refracting light even in the gloom, and I could smell the sea and picture the roiling waves. The wind was like something alive. It entered every pore of me, and it, too, had a smell, carrying with it the earthiness of the marsh reeds. I had tried to ignore the change in the confined space of the tower, but my senses still seemed too acute, too sharp. I was adapting to it, but at times like this, I remembered that just a day ago, I had been someone else. We took turns standing watch. Loss of sleep seemed less foolhardy than letting the psychologist sneak up on us unannounced. She knew the location of every perimeter tripwire, and we had no time to disarm and reset them. I let the surveyor take the first watch as a gesture of good faith. In the middle of the night, the surveyor came in to wake me up for the second shift, but I was already awake because of the thunder. Grumpily, she headed off to bed. I doubt she trusted me. I just think she couldn't keep her eyes open a moment longer after the stresses of the day. The rain renewed its intensity. I didn't worry that we'd be blown away. These tents were army regulation and could withstand anything short of a hurricane. But if I was going to be awake anyway, I wanted to experience the storm. So I walked outside into the welter of the stinging water. The gusting pockets of wind. I already could hear the surveyor snoring in her tent. She probably had slept through much worse. The dull emergency lights glowed from the edges of the camp, making the tents into triangles of shadow. Even the darkness seemed more alive to me, surrounding me like something physical. I can't even say it was a sinister presence. I felt in that moment as if it were all a dream. The training, my former life, the world I had left behind. None of that mattered anymore. Only this place mattered. Only this moment. And not because the psychologist had hypnotized me. In the grip of that powerful emotion, I stared out toward the coast, through the jagged, narrow spaces between the trees. There, a greater darkness gathered, the confluence of the night, the clouds, and the sea, somewhere beyond another border. Then, through that darkness, I saw it, a flicker of orange light, just a touch of illumination, too far up in the sky. This puzzled me, until I realized it must originate with the lighthouse. As I watched, the flicker moved to the left and up slightly before being snuffed out, then reappeared a few minutes later, much higher, then was snuffed out for good. I waited for the light to return, but it never did. For some reason, the longer the light stayed out, the more restless I became, as if in this strange place a light, any sort of light, was a sign of civilization. There had been a storm that final full day alone with my husband after he returned from the 11th expedition, a day that had the clarity of dream, of something strange yet familiar, familiar routine but strange calmness, even more than I had become accustomed to before he left. In those last weeks before the expedition, we had argued violently. I had shoved him up against a wall, thrown things at him. Anything to break through the armor of resolve that I know now might have been thrust upon him by hypnotic suggestion. If you go, I had told him, you might not come back, and you can't be sure I'll be waiting for you if you do, which had made him laugh infuriatingly and say, Oh, have you been waiting for me all this time? Have I arrived yet? He was set in his course by then, and any obstruction was a source of rough humor for him, and that would have been entirely natural, hypnosis or not. It was entirely in keeping with his personality to become set on something and follow it, regardless of the consequences, to let an impulse become a compulsion, especially if he thought he was contributing to a cause greater than himself. It was one reason he had stayed in the Navy for a second tour. Our relationship had been thready for a while, in part because he was gregarious and I preferred solitude. This had once been a source of strength in our relationship, but no longer. Not only had I found him handsome, but I admired his confident, outgoing nature, his need to be around people. I recognized this as a healthy counterbalance to my personality. He had a good sense of humor, too, and when we first met at a crowded local park, he snuck past my reticence by pretending we were both detectives working a case and were there to watch a suspect, which led to making up facts about the lives of the busy hive of people buzzing around us, and then about each other. At first, I must have seemed mysterious to him, my guardedness, my need to be alone, even after he thought he'd gotten inside my defenses. Either I was a puzzle to be solved, or he just thought that once he got to know me better, he could still break through to some other place, some core where another person lived inside of me. During one of our fights, he admitted as much, tried to make his volunteering for the expedition a sign of how much I'd pushed him away, before taking it back later, ashamed. I told him point blank, so there would be no mistake. This person he wanted to know better did not exist. I was who I seemed to be from the outside. That would never change. Early in our relationship, I had told my husband about the swimming pool as we lay in bed, something we did a lot of back then. He had been captivated, possibly even thinking there were more interesting revelations to come. He had pushed aside the parts that spoke of an isolated childhood to focus entirely on the pool itself.
I would have sailed boats on it.
Captain by old Flopper, no doubt, I replied, and everything would have been happy and wonderful.
No, because I would have found you surly and willful and grim. Fairly grim.
I would have found you frivolous and wished really hard for the turtles to scuttle your boat.
If they did, I would just have rebuilt it even better and told everyone about the grim kid who talked to frogs.
I had never talked to the frogs. I despised anthropomorphizing animals. So, what has changed if we wouldn't have liked each other as kids? I asked.
Oh, I would have liked you despite that, he said, grinning. You would have fascinated me, and I would have followed you anywhere without hesitation.
So we fit back then, in our odd way. We clicked by being opposites and took pride in the idea that this made us strong. We reveled in this construct so much for so long that it was a wave that did not break until after we were married, and then it destroyed us over time in depressingly familiar ways. But none of this, the good or the bad, mattered when he returned from the expedition. I asked no questions, did not bring up any of our past arguments. I knew when I woke up beside him that morning after his return that our time together was already running out. I made him breakfast while outside the rain beat down, lightning cracking nearby. We sat at the kitchen table, which had a view through the sliding glass doors of the backyard, and had an excruciatingly polite conversation over eggs and bacon. He admired the gray shape of the new bird feeder I had put in, and the water feature that now rippled with raindrops. I asked him if he had gotten enough sleep and how he felt. I even asked again questions from the night before, like whether the journey back had been tough.
No, he said. Effortless,
flashing an imitation of his old infuriating smile. How long did it take? I asked.
No time at all.
I couldn't read his expression, but in its blankness I sensed something mournful, something left inside that wanted to communicate but couldn't. My husband had never been mournful or melancholy as long as I had known him, and this frightened me a little. He asked me how my research was going, and I told him about some of the new developments. At the time, I worked for a company devoted to the creation of natural products that broke down plastics and other non-biodegradable substances. It was boring. Before that, I had been out in the field taking advantage of various research grants. Before that, I had been a radical environmentalist, participating in protests and employed by a non-profit to call potential donors on the phone. And your work? I asked, tentative, not sure how much more circling I could do, ready at a moment's notice to dart away from the mystery.